Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club World Affairs. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. This was organized in addition to the speakers with the following support from these different organizations: Pacific Links Foundation, Legacies of War, Veterans for Peace, and the Progressive Vietnamese American Organization. We're here today as part of three different programs we're doing here at the Commonwealth Club about the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. I think it's one thing for people our age, those of you who are my age, that is, I don't mean to denigrate the rest of you who are young, but for people our age, I think one thing we don't really think about is that when we were 15, 16, 17, 18, 20 years old in the late 60s or so, that World War I was only 50 years earlier, you know, had it ended, World War I. And Vietnam has now ended 50 years earlier. And you know how we thought about World War I. No, long gone. There was the World War II and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's very important to remember that as we're doing this, but that we, again, what should have been done with World War I is try to learn some lessons from the thing before you did it, repeated it again, you know, 20 years, 30 years later. So, and we have done that. You know, we have made the same mistakes again. So tonight we're going to focus on the personal and not as much of the history. We have a great and very well-known speaker here today, Nguyen Phan Quy Mai, and she's the author of two novels, Dust Child and The Mountains Sing, and she has just recently published a book of poetry, The Color of Peace. So she's here to talk about her experiences as a child in Vietnam and then what she's been doing ever since. Now, we have to interview her, Craig McNamara. The name is familiar to our generation. This is the son of Robert McNamara. As I interviewed him when his book came out, Because Our Fathers Lied, in 2022. So if you want to hear all about his book, you can get it on the YouTube channel that the Commonwealth Club has. You just put his name in mine. You'll have it right away. And it was interesting because, you know, while his father was Secretary of Defense, he was leading the opposition at Stanford University to the war. And I think this is a very, very difficult position to be in. And there are a few other people from that time that were in this position. And I thought it was just fascinating book about it. So Craig is going to be doing the interviewing. And not surprisingly, he's been interested in agriculture and production his whole life instead of destruction. So these are our two speakers today. And we're going to start with Quy Mai, who is going to talk about her childhood and start that way.
My mother's rise. Through the eyes of my childhood, I watched my mother, who labored in a kitchen built from straw and mud. She lifted a pair of chopsticks and twirled sunlight into a pot of boiling rice. The perfume of a new harvest soaked her worn shirt as she bent and fed rice jaws to the hungry flames. I wanted to come and help, but the child in me pulled myself into a dark corner where I could wash my mother's face, teach beauty how to glow in hardship, and how to sing the rice to cook with her sun-baked hands. That day in our kitchen, I saw how perfection was arranged by soot blackened pans and pots and by the bent back of my mother. So thin, she would disappear if I wept or cried out. Giang bếp của mẹ. Qua đôi mắt tuổi thơ, tôi nhìn mẹ tôi tất tả trong gian bếp được dựng lên bằng rơm và bùn quánh. Mẹ nhấc đũa lên quấy nắng vào nồi cơm đang sôi. Và kháo mẹ dịch đẫm hương thơm của mùa gặt mới, tay mẹ mớm rơm khô cho ngọn lửa đói bập bùng. Tôi muốn đến cạnh bên vài giúp mẹ, nhưng đứa trẻ trong tôi kéo tôi chui vào góc bếp tối thẳm. Từ nơi đó, tôi nhìn gương mặt mẹ dạy vẻ đẹp cách bừng lên trong gian khổ và cách hát cho cơm sôi bằng đôi tay rám nắng của người. Ngày hôm đó, trong gian bếp của tuổi thơ tôi, sự hoàn hảo được sắp đặt bằng những chiếc nồi đen tuyền bồ hông, và bởi chiếc lưng khom của mẹ mỏng manh trong chân sẽ biến mất nếu tôi khóc hay kêu lên. Thank you so much for being here today. I started this conversation with a poem about my mom because I saw my mom in Greg's writing. In his book, Because Our Father, he dedicated to his mom, to Margaret McKintry Gregg. She gave me her maiden name, her Pacific blue eyes, and her love for nature. It is her love that has guided my life's journey. It is my mother's love that also guided my life's journey. So I'd like to you to meet Gregg. Through our good friend Ron Carver, I was introduced to Gregg. And then I visited his home and his farm last Saturday. And he spent the whole afternoon with me and Julie as well and his family members. I think it was one of the highlights of my life, sitting at the back in his truck with his grandchild in his arm driving us.
Don't forget the dog.
And the dog, one dog running in front of us, one dog sitting in my lap. It was a moment of being a family. And I can't tell you that when I grew up inside Vietnam, how I felt about Greg's father. If it was not for Greg's book, I would not have met him. I want to tell you that literature is the pillar of love. And I want to thank you for inviting so many of your families and friends here. Greg emailed everyone and said, come. Please, thank you for being here. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. What an incredible fortune it is. How fortunate I am, my family, to meet you. And to honor our mothers, thank you. It means so much to me. And in the short time that we've met, I've learned so much about you and your country, your family, your mother and your father. We shared stories. We were driving along, as you said, on this beautiful Saturday afternoon through the orchards. And we were looking at all sorts of blooms and crops and sheep and the watershed that is just so fresh and verdant. And at the end, you said, our countries are so different, didn't you? And they are. They're so remarkably unique. Mm-hmm. And to understand that difference is really what we're all about. That's what we're all about here today. That's what this 50th commemoration is all about. And I just want to pause for a second and think about the fact that we both stuck our hands into the rich soil along Puta Creek, and we realized we're both farmers. You're a farmer. You were born in 1973 in northern Vietnam. You helped your mother and father as a young girl, planting your rice paddies, harvesting the rice, harvesting shrimp to feed your family, to sell to your neighbors. You lived with a scar of the war. You were incredibly impoverished, without food. And now you are harvesting your words and your poems in these beautiful books that we have. The two that you mentioned and this brand new one that has brought so much joy to me and sorrow and sadness. And that's what we're really here to talk about today. I wonder if you'd take a few moments and just tell us a little bit about that childhood. What in that journey brought you to be a writer? How did that happen?
Thank you so much, Greg. I said that our countries are so different because, like, your farm, when I came to your farm, I didn't know it was like 200 hectares. Mm-hmm. And I was working on a farm, but it was like, I think it was a few times bigger than this room. And my father cultivated this piece of land on a dike because we were so poor, we didn't have money to buy land. So this piece of land was the practice shooting range of the Southern Vietnamese Army. So when I was growing up, I was digging up bullets so that we could have soil to grow rice. But we were starving. It was under the American trade embargo. You know, we did not have enough to eat. So on this we dug up thousands and thousands of bullet cases and unexploded bullets. And I felt I was touching death. But on that field of death, we grew life. My father, I dedicated the color of peace to my father because I remember when it didn't rain, my father would walk so far to the closest pond and he would scoop up the water with buckets and carry it to the field. And my brothers and I were saying, no, you know, like, because it was so hot, the water just disappeared when he poured it. But he kept going, because you know why? Three family members of his died in the Great Hunger of 1945. His own mom, his brother, his uncle, he was scared of being hungry. And he was scared that his kids could go hungry. So he worked day and night, but he never stopped believing in the power of literature. It was him who built me the very first bookshelf. He grew bamboo in our garden and built my very first bookshelf. And any saving that he had, he bought books for me to read and he inspired me to become a writer. So later I will read a poem about him. But he really is, you know, and I'm like, we are here to talk about our fathers as well, because I also had misunderstanding with my father. I had things I could not tell him. Yeah. And through reading your book, I know the deep love you have for your father. Mm-hmm. You love not only your father, your mom, your wife, Julie, your children, your grandchildren, your humanity. I felt that love. But then you had to admit in your book that your father is a war criminal. I was devastated when I read it. And I'm so sorry that you had to confront that truth. Mm. But you were so brave. And I think today I had a radio interview and I was asked, in this difficult time, why do I still have hope? Mm. And I said, I had hope because I met brave people like you, who dare to confront the difficult history, because we need to learn our lessons, like George said. I was 6 years old when I was standing on the village road, the dirt road of my village in North Vietnam. I was looking at the devastation around me, at the people who lost their arms and legs and their family members. And I told myself, the human race could not be so stupid as to wage another war. Just look at this. As a 6 years old, I believed in that. And now I know that I was too naive. There is too much power, too much greed behind every war. But Greg, your bravery, your courage gives me hope. So I want to ask you, how difficult was it for you to write this memoir? And what did it take you to write it?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. As I began writing my book, as a farmer, as Julie and I are farmers, I thought it would be about agriculture. I thought it would be about climate change. I thought it would be about the things that we struggle with every day to bring the most nutritious and wonderful bounty of food to you, to our consumers across America and across the world. And as I began to unpeel my life, and I thought it would be about my mom. And as I began to unpeel things, it was my father. And I realized that my entire adult life, in one way or another, had been lived through the lens of Vietnam. And so through remarkable people like you, other authors and writers and poets and filmmakers, and through a wonderful person who we all know and cherish, Daniel Ellsberg, I learned so much. And those of you who know Daniel, when you speak with him, you need to have your yellow legal pad, your pen. You need to have about 2.5 hours, because when you begin a conversation about Robert McNamara, when you begin a conversation about the Pentagon Papers, you need to sit down and listen, get your questions ready. And I learned so much that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I've learned that I could have put that into a regretful category, but I've learned to put it into a category of missed opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so being with you today, being with you on the farm, for Julie and me to have been in Vietnam, I'm filling in those lost opportunities. And it just, the issue that you bring up is so conflicting to me because of the love that I've experienced in all of my years with my family. And I think it was through Errol Morris, the documentary filmmaker who made The Fog of War, Daniel Ellsberg, and others, who I really came to the conclusion, and specifically on this most recent trip of being in Vietnam, I was returned to a battlefield called Ia Drang. I did not know of the Battle of Ia Drang, November 14th of 1965, a very, very major conquest between the Arvin, South Vietnamese, U.S. troops, and the Viet Cong. And what I didn't know was that at the end of that battle, my father was in Saigon on November 28th, 1965, and was flown over the battlefield in a helicopter to surmise what had happened at this battle. And what I've read in his memoir, and what I was told by your countrymen and women, was that he realized that the war at that point was not winnable. Mm. November 28th, 1965.
If he admitted the truth, he would have saved so many lives. Mm. So many people have died since then.
So I do contemplate, what could he have done? He could have left the administration. He could have left his job as Secretary of Defense. He could have joined with Bobby Kennedy. He could have joined with Martin Luther King. He could have been a voice for peace against the war. And I wish that he had. And now I wish, because I know you're going to ask me, what would it be like
to have a conversation with your father
about
your book?
If he could read this book today. And I didn't choose the timing of this book post his death. I would wish that we had had this opportunity. Mm. Want to sit down?
Yeah. Because the flowers match my dress, you see?
But I wish he had had this opportunity. It would have been sad. It would have been really challenging. But it would have created the conversation that we never had.
Yeah. But you tried to talk to your father a few times. Your memoir reflected that. And he avoided talking with you, right? But I think because, you know, he did question you about the interview in the Mother Jones magazine.
Jay just sent me that article. What was the date of that? 1986 or something?
85.
So just on that note, Mother Jones came out to the farm and did an interview, Sons of Decision Makers, and I was one of those. And I, for the first time ever in public, said that our relationship had problems. And I went on to describe those problems, and who would have thought Robert McNamara would ever get a copy of Mother Jones? A few days later, Craig, did you really say that in Mother Jones? Yes, I did. That's what I said.
So this memoir really brought me to tears many times, and I read it twice and still cried like a baby when I read it the second time. So, you know, growing up, I read a poem from Tho Ho, the well-known Vietnamese poet, about Norman Morrison burning himself alive to protest against the war. And then I read this in your memoir. The year I started boarding school, Norman Morrison stood beneath Dad's dad's office window at the Pentagon, dosed himself in kerosene and self-immolate. His daughter, Emily, was by his side for months afterward. For every breath that I took, I felt selfish. I felt ashamed to be alive. Mm-hmm. I think it was very brave for you to admit that. But you took your shame further. You refused to bear it. I was visiting your farm, and I thought you could have lived a very peaceful life among nature. You don't have to admit all of this, but you take action and you came back to Vietnam and you met with victims of Agent Orange. You have been advocating for the rights of veterans of all sides and victims of wars, from victims of unexploded bombs and victims of Agent Orange. So what compelled you to do that? And were you afraid when you first went to Vietnam?
Oh, I was not afraid. It was an amazing journey. And those of you who have not yet traveled, please do. And please consult with Quy Mai and myself. We will help you. The Vietnamese people are the most gracious, kind, peaceful, accepting people I've ever met. And so joyful to have had that experience. It is said often, and I've actually asked you and others subsequently, concerning the American War, concerning the Vietnam War, that the Vietnamese will forgive but never forget. And I've really questioned people, is that true? Because this most recent trip that Julie and I were on, I met with soldiers who had fought at Ia Drang 60 years ago, who had not returned to that battlefield in 60 years, where they lost 1,000 of their comrades. And we hugged and held hands. It's just an amazing process of forgiveness. So on that note, please know that what your country is doing and has done is so important. I know that you and I are going to talk about reconciliation, which is so important, which is what this 50th anniversary is all about. I know how challenging it is for many people. I wanted to pause for a second because you did mention Norman Morrison. I did not know about that. I was 15 years old, and I probably did not know of his death in front of my father's office until I was 25. And I did not know of the book that his wife wrote and the poems that she wrote until just more recently. Mm. I learned when I first went to Vietnam what a hero Norman Morrison is, that there's a stamp in his honor. And you as a young girl recited poems about him. Mm. They're so beautiful. So to answer your question, to be in Vietnam for me will be a continuous journey. It's part of my legacy. It's who I am. Mm-hmm. And so discovering it fully is very rich. It's an opportunity mostly to listen and to act and to encourage us to act, particularly at this time.
Yes, we need to act particularly at this time. I do agree. And you know, talking about, answer your question about how Vietnamese people feel towards Americans, we welcome you because you bring dollars. we need American tourists at the moment because we are facing the risk of paying 46% tax. I have so many friends in Vietnam who are devastated because their businesses depend on exports. You know, so many jobs depend on exports. And so, yeah, there's so much to be done. But I also want to reflect about the years I worked as a volunteer to translate poetry. I was translating poetry from, Vietnamese veterans of all sides of the war and also American veterans and facilitate poetry reading. And I remember at one of these poetry readings, there's this American veteran who hugged me and who cried so much. And he said he did not dare to return to Vietnam for more than 40 years because whenever he dreamed about returning to Vietnam, he would dream about being chased on the street by some Vietnamese with a knife. And then he was crying and he said, why are you Vietnamese people are so welcoming? And I said, the Vietnamese poet Nguyễn Du wrote, nói cho cùng trong mỗi cuộc chiến tranh phe nào thắng thì nhân dân đều bại. In the end of each and every war, whoever wins, the people always lose. I've seen so much trauma, so much pain in veterans, Vietnamese veterans, Afghan veterans, American veterans. Nobody wins with war. And I really hope that the human race would grow up one day.
Mm.
So we recognize that we are all children of Mother Earth. We are here to help and love each other as brothers and sisters. But we are destroying our nature. We are destroying, you know, we're killing each other.
On the note of returning veterans, would you read the poem on Tears of Quang Tri?
Okay.
I have a copy.
I find my book here. Thank you for asking me to read this poem, because this experience changed my life. It was in 1994 when I was a student on a scholarship to Australia. I brought some Australian friends to Quang Tri, an area that suffered from a lot of American bombings. We were sitting by the roadside drinking tea when a naked woman ran towards us, howling, "Tears of Quang Tri." After the last American soldiers had left Vietnam and grass had softened bomb craters into scars, I took some overseas friends to Quang Tri, once a fierce battlefield. I was too young for the war to crawl under my skin, so when I sat with my friends at a roadside cafe, sipping tea, enjoying the green landscape, I didn't know how to react when a stark naked woman rushed towards us, howling. Her ribs protruded like the bones of a skinned fish, her breast swaying like long moob fruit, and her pubic hair a black jungle. I was too young to know what to say when the woman shouted to my overseas friends to return to her husband and children. Stunned, we watched her fight off these villagers who snatched her arms and dragged her away. She has been crazy, the tea seller said. Her house was bombed, her husband and children. She has been looking for them ever since. How young I had been to let myself believe that green grass could heal bomb craters into scars. This was a real story that happened in 1994, 19 years after the war. And this mother was still looking for her kids and her husband.
Mm, mm. Another part of the sorrow that you and I have spoken of, again about soldiers, men and women from the United States that served during the 60s in the American War, reminds me of a friend who I don't know if we ever met. His name is Richard Rusk. His father is Dean Rusk. And the only time we might have met was when our fathers were sworn in January. And we had this amazing 10, maybe 15-year friendship over the phone. He told me stories of when he was in boot camp and he was returning from boot camp in Georgia to Washington, D.C. to spend Christmas with his family. And he got the last seat on the bus. One more stop, and another soldier comes on. No seats on the bus for this young soldier. And so Richard gets up and lets him sit down. That young soldier is Ron Kovic. So Richard and his father had a much bigger distance than my father and I did in geographic. He went to Alaska for, I believe, 16 years and eventually returned to Georgia. He and his father wrote a memoir about their differences. His father never really changed his position. Jumping forward, our daughter, Emily, and I traveled to Vietnam in November of 2017, had an amazing trip. And before that trip and upon returning, Richard was planning a trip with his son to Vietnam in 2018. It would have been a commemoration of the My Lai massacre. And he was asking me in his emails, Craig, do you think that the Vietnamese will accept me? Well, what will they think of me? Well, how will they see the difference between my father and myself? And I said, Richard, our experience is just what I've told you. It was the most remarkable journey of my life. And please do it. And Richard took his own life.
I'm so sorry. I wish I could have met Richard, you know, to hug him and to say it's not his fault. So maybe I could read a poem that I've written. I must tell you that I wrote in my novel, Dust Giant, the relationships surrounded the Vietnam War, regardless of where they come from or where they go, are linked by blood, blood that was shed during the war and blood which is still being shed until today, 50 years. On Hanoi Street, he was so tall. When I looked up at him, in his eyes, I wanted to see the Statue of Liberty bathed in the sunlight of his homeland. Instead, regret rolled down his face, trembling on his cheeks. My Lai, he said, I just visited My Lai. And in his eyes, the photos he had seen at the site of the massacre came back. A mother clutching her son in their deaths. Bodies of barefoot women strewn across muddy paths. Naked children, cold and silent, under the feet of American soldiers who stood and smoked. You weren't involved. I shook my head. It was the war. Yet he shuddered. It had taken him 42 years to come back. Each of his days filled with nightmares and the fear that some Vietnamese would run him down with knives on the street. I wanted to say something else, but words are too small, so I pull him into the Hanoi life, rushing around us, women balancing basket of bursting flowers on their slender shoulders, men cycling autumn away on their cyclos, girls giggling their way to school, their outsides fluttering like the wings of white doves. This used to be the enemy capital for me, he whispered as we passed a group of boys who stood in a circle, kicking a feathered ball to each other, their laughter rising upward. He jumped back as the feathered ball flew towards us. Kick it, uncle, kick it! The boys called out to him, the American, in Vietnamese, their arms opening, inviting. For a moment, the tall American man stood frozen by fearful thoughts. But as the feather ball dipped, spinning fast downward, his face broadened into a smile, wide, generous, like somehow the Red River. The soldier who had lost his youth on the soil of my homeland reached his foot forward, sending the ball high, his whole body leaning towards the boys.
One of the things that we really wanted to want to talk about is reconciliation. And give us a thread, Khoi Mai, of how we can, what we can do, what you and I, what this marvelous group of friends can do here to continue that journey. And when I think about, you know, I think about it in so many diverse and unique ways. When I was in Vietnam this most recent trip and traveling with this unique group of Vietnamese journalists and cinematographers, we met with many groups of people who had fought in the war, who had resisted the war. I have to tell one short little story about meeting Madame Cham. Madame Cham and I were born in 1950, and Madame Cham has earned nine hero awards given to her by Ho Chi Minh for her bravery as a Viet Cong soldier, for her sharpshooter. And I embraced her as M. Cham, which means Sister Cham. And I meant that. And as I was expressing our friendship and receiving her friendship, I was also thinking about our men and women who fought against M. Cham. And so I have a lot to do with reconciliation. I have a long pathway ahead of me. Tell me your journey. Tell me our journey. Tell us what we can do for the millions of Vietnamese friends who are here in this country, for the tens of millions of Vietnamese who are in South Vietnam, and your country as a whole. What can we continue to do in our long work towards unification and reconciliation?
Thank you so much for this important question. I think there's so much to do. First of all, I think we should listen to each other, right? Sharing each other's story and helping each other heal. People in Vietnam still die from the impact of unexploded bombs. No victims of Agent Orange has been compensated. There are mothers who are taking care of deformed babies in Vietnam. And the companies who reap billions of dollars of profit from producing and selling this chemical, they never admitted responsibility in helping these Vietnamese families, you know. So I think there should be more advocacy for acceptance of responsibilities in that area. But I feel like, and of course, you know, Vietnamese and Americans should exchange stories like this. We understand, we humanize each other. But I think work needs to be done in one area, which is reconciliation among the Vietnamese community. In my book, The Mountain Sing, I documented a really painful truth. Mm-hmm. You know, the American war in Vietnam, or the Vietnam War, killed more than 3 million Vietnamese. There are many family members who had members fight against each other, north against south. I mean, it's easy to forgive, you know, outsider. But when it comes to Vietnamese people, to your blood, it's difficult to forgive because people really fought against each other. Vietnamese killing Vietnamese. So to answer that question, I want to talk about the work of, you know, Pacific Link Foundation, the Progressive Vietnamese American Organization, Legacies of War, who are doing incredible work in bringing, you know, our community together. And I'm honored to introduce you to Isabel T. Pilau, who founded the Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network. She co-founded it with some people, including Viet Thanh Nguyen, who won the Pulitzer Prize. And Isabel and Viet and many people have been, you know, volunteering their time to bring our community together through literature. So even though I'm Vietnamese, I have a Vietnamese passport, they championed my work. Viet was the first person who interviewed me about the Mountain Sing, and D. Van gave me the first ever residency. And, you know, because that work is risky, because I remember doing my first trip to the U.S., I made an appointment to see a Vietnamese-American poet, and he asked me to read my poetry to him during our meeting. And afterwards, he said, "Quê Mai, do you know what? Last night, I received 3 phone calls from my Vietnamese friends here in Orange County. They told me not to meet you because you're from Vietnam. You are a communist because your work is published there." You see, so it's very tricky. So it's very brave by Isabel and D. Van to support my work, and they're doing incredible things. So talking about reconciliation, can Isabel tell us about the work, reconciliation work that you've been doing? Please come here.
Yes, I'm. Thank you, and I'm moved, you know, by your poem and by your tears. I mean, I had no idea about your journey, and Koimai told me about you, and thank you. You know, thank you. And the work that the Diaspora Vietnamese Artists Network is about reconciliations, about because our community has been spread in different countries because of the war, because of colonialism, right? This accent is French, right? And French Vietnamese and mixed too. So there's also issue there. But my purpose in life is to speed up the process of acceptance here in the U.S., of sense of belonging, but also creating dialogues between writers in the U.S., in France, Australia, in Canada, and in Vietnam by, you know, publishing books, you know. And then it's incredible, right? A few people get together in 3 years. We have published 18 books, translating books from different language, doing residencies.
Oh, and one of the books that D. Van published is the translation of the latest poetry short story collection of Bảo Ninh, who wrote The Sorrow of War. And Bảo Ninh fought for the Northern Vietnamese Army against the father of Viet Thanh Nguyen, for example. So the fact that D. Van supported his work is really life-changing.
Yes. Yes, thank you. And then we also translating book by Vietnamese Americans into Vietnam, into Vietnamese that they ban over there, but we know they'll make them their way over there. So we do that. So all of you, I mean, if you want to know, look at our website. We do like 6 programs to speed up that process and help with reconciliations. But I invite all of you on Saturday to come to our events with Viet Thanh Nguyen and all the Vietnamese American poets from different parts of the countries to hear like how we commemorate it. And it's going to be at the Sydney Golden Theatre Saturday evening. So I have some postcards outside if you want to know about it, you know, talk to me or go to the website. But I don't want to take too much of your time. But thank you for making space.
Thank you so much, Isabel.
Hmm. I see George coming. Oh, you want to take that?
I'll just take that.
Good.
Thank you. And because this, I can't... Because I want to acknowledge also my work with diasporic Vietnamese people really changed my life. I would not have been able to write The Mountain Sing and Dust Giant without acknowledging this painful history. Because when I was growing up in Vietnam, sometimes my classmates would disappear from my class because they would become boat people. And until today, I don't know what happened to some of my friends who had left our homeland in search of a safer life. Thorn of Roses. For Chúc Mỹ Tuệ, Teresa Mai Chúc. You take me to this garden where the roses open the nectar of the morning sun, each slender petal shivering in the soft wind 8,000 miles from our homeland. The roses listen as you tell me about your trip out to sea on a tiny boat, sardine among starving people, your mother and brother, skeletons among them. How at 2 years old you had to flee our homeland into the arms of waves so tall even heaven was dark. How your boat ran out of petrol and those who died from illness or starvation did not have the grace of a coffin, their bodies tossed into the churning mouth of the ocean, and how your non-stop crying made your mother want to jump headfirst out of the boat. The journey had been long for both of us, but you are here today with me in this rose garden filled with the intense California sun, longing for homeland and dreaming. But the scent of roses tells me how knives flung from the past still cut into you and make you bleed. Tuệ Mi, Teresa Mai Chúc. We both inherited the war. We inherited the thorn of roses that still stab us. We inherited a yearning for peace that we knit into stories. We are the daughters of the same mother, Vietnam, who live on two sides of the ocean, bound together by thorns and by the scent of this morning's roses, and by the stories that will never set us free unless we tell them.
Thank you.
I know we're coming up on questions from you all, and I have one last question for you, or many questions, but for this moment. Our fathers, you shared with me several stories in the short time that we had on the farm about your father. And I want to end with a poem that you wrote. It's the last poem in your book, but I want you to tell just a quick story. When you were born in 73, I believe in 79, you moved from the north to the south. And you are not welcomed. You are a northerner. And your neighbors threw stones at your aluminum roof to disrupt your life and your sleep. Your father said, "Kwemai, you must cut your hair to look north, to look like a Western young girl." Tell us a little bit, as we conclude here, about your father and the poem that you've written as your last entry in your anthology.
Thank you. So, you know, my father was really determined to give his kids the best education and, you know, and the good food. So he said life in the South was abundant with food because, like, the weather was much better. So he uprooted us and moved us to Bạc Liêu at the very southern top, southern tip of the Mekong Delta. But I did not know that I would become a refugee in my own country, because the war divided us for more than 20 years, and northerners speak a different accent compared to the southerners. We dressed so differently. And at that time, you know, it was after the war, it was in 1979, and things were very difficult. Like in the south, the government was sending people from the north to take over managerial jobs. There were a lot of campaigns to punish capitalists, right? So southerners, they were getting very upset at northerners like us. So, you know, there was resentment. I was bullied. But later on, then I became friends with northerners, and I listened to their stories. I understood the roots of their resentment, and I understood my father's effort to build a good life for all of us. Because from my village in the north, I was born in a small village in Khương Du. The village is called Khương Du. And my father said no one from this village could ever go to university. And he dreamt for my two brothers and me to be able to go to university. So he took us to this place with good schooling, and he worked so hard so we could go to university, because my mother and he, they never had the chance to go to university. So I think, but I had so much resentment to my father. You could read it in one of my essays in the book. But I became a better daughter when I became a writer, because when I became a writer, I researched about our complicated history. I could understand some of the reasons of his behavior, and I could talk to him, and I could love him more. And he became my best friend. So last year, in 2024, I was in the U.S. for the launch of the paperback of Dust Child, when I received a horrible news that he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He was a man who exercised 2 hours per day. He got up every day at 4:30 to do his morning exercise. And still, but he was already 86, but still he was so young and full of life and full of love for life. So I canceled my book tour, flew home to Vietnam, stayed with him for the last 3 months of his life. I could not write about him for so many months after his passing. It was the most painful experience of my life. But thanks to Divan, I had a very healing experience, a residency in Hue, the imperial capital of Vietnam. So I wrote a poem for my father. Would you like to hear it? Wings for my father, Nguyễn Thanh Cầm. Larger than my hand, the color of sky, and a patch of red fire on its wings. The butterfly lands on a flower and flutters, as if wanting to fan away my tears. Standing next to your grave today, I see you returning to us on the butterfly's wings, bringing the freedom of the endless sky, blazing it onto my mother's open palms. Your hands carried my childhood, led my adulthood through storms. Your hand now resting under green grass, lifting new flowers to bloom towards the sky. Flowers, the color of an internal flame that burns for us. Father, please fly towards freedom, carried by millions of butterfly wings. In honor of my mother, my father's memory, the believer of peace, I'm donating 100% proceeds from this book to three organizations that support victims of the Vietnam War. Renew, who was started by Chuck, who was a veteran of the Vietnam War and who's been volunteering years of his life to bring Vietnam and the U.S. together. Second organization is Peace Tree Vietnam, founded by Jerry. Her brother was an American pilot during the Vietnam War. He was shot down when he tried to rescue some other Americans. The day that she heard the news of his death, she was in her kitchen. She thought about her mom, about so many Vietnamese and American moms who lost their sons. And she promised herself one day, when the war ended, she would have to do something to bring the two countries together. So she started Peace Tree Vietnam. Peace Tree Vietnam removes unexploded bombs from Vietnam and plant trees. They are building kindergartens and schools and library. They have so many people who volunteer for them. The third organization is the Dove Fund. Also, we have so many volunteers who are American veterans and Vietnamese Americans, and they're having a lot of projects to help victims of Agent Orange, to build clinic, to build homes for victims of Agent Orange. So thank you for your support.
Well, this is a perfect segue to have you ask some questions if you have anything that's...
Absolutely. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and while we're getting started there...
Doris.
Yeah.
Hi. Thank you so much for what you've been sharing. I'm really curious where you learned how to speak English so well. Perfectly well.
Thank you so much. It's the first time I have a poetry reading in English. Normally, I read poetry in Vietnamese. So, you know, before, you know, I must thank Ron Carver, who developed this beautiful poster for me, thanks to the help of his friend Paul. Where's you, Paul? Paul, thank you so much. And, you know, Ron convinced me that my poetry in English is good enough. So he connected me with a publisher, Black Ocean, and this is the first time I read my poetry in English, and I thought I couldn't do it, but thanks to you, I felt really confident. So thank you. But to answer your question, I did not have the chance to learn English until my eighth grade because I grew up in Vietnam. My school did not have an English teacher, and I was really lucky that there was this teacher, Thầy Trương Văn Ánh, who felt sorry for the poor kids in rural area who went there as a volunteer. So he gave free lessons. But at that time, we did not know how to speak. We learned the grammar, and then we just imitated from cassette tapes because we did not have TV. So we only listened to cassette tapes and then we learned from the textbooks. And very lucky that when I entered university, I won a scholarship from the Australian government to study in Australia. So from when I was 18 years old, I went to Australia to study business. Not because I wanted to become a writer, but my family told me, we don't have enough to eat. What do you want to do being a writer? So I went on to study business. But of course, you know, fate brought me back to literature, and I learned English every day still. I wrote The Mountain Singing and Dust Child with a Vietnamese English dictionary. But I want to write it like a Vietnamese. So I have a lot of proverbs, a lot of Vietnamese saying in the book as well, because I want to infuse my writing in English with Vietnamese culture, Vietnamese traditions as well. So thank you.
First of all, I want to thank you for doing your poem at the beginning, or your opening in Vietnamese. It was beautiful. I remembered as a kid watching TV during the war and hearing Vietnamese speak, and it really took me back to that moment. I've been moved. My neighbor was killed in Vietnam. And it's moving to hear your stories. And I was struck by a parallel. North and South fighting, just like in our country, different languages, different tone, voice, or accent between the North and the South like we have. And I was wondering about the healing that's going on between North and South. If you could say more about that, how it's going, what your feeling is about the healing. I mean, in some ways, we still suffer that here in the United States. Mm. It's not totally healed. Mm. So.
Thank you so much for that question. So much work still needs to do for our Vietnamese community for healing. Because, for example, some Vietnamese Americans, the older generation, still refuse to go back to Vietnam. And they told their children not to go back. Right? And some Vietnamese from within Vietnam still condemn the people who fought alongside the American. And calling them Nguy, the illegitimate, which is the official word we had in our textbook. I was growing up reading that kind of demeaning term. And now I learn not to use that. And I advocate, I highlight the impact of that because, like, I want everyone to acknowledge the humanity of the other side. So the work of DVAN, what we're doing, very important. My work as a writer, I want to champion. I want to heal through literature. You know, I think because with literature, we see the humanity of the other side. And I think, you know, like because of censorship in Vietnam, a lot of Vietnamese diasporic writers cannot be translated and published in Vietnam. So there's a lack of exchange of stories. And because of the lack of translation, a lot of Vietnamese writers are not available. Their work is not available in English for the younger generation of Vietnamese in the US to read. Mm. So, you know, we need more forums to bring together Vietnamese from all sides, you know, to present our stories. Because through storytelling, we connect. I always believe that the weapon for war is dehumanization, and the weapon for peace is humanization. And literature is really our weapon for peace.
That's really a great point, and I want to bring it out to an even bigger issue in our society. And I'm going to go to Craig on this one first. We have what we call cancel culture. Instead of understanding somebody else's point of view or understanding like you do with your father, well, he had a certain point of view and a certain ideology that more got in his way than his personality, for example, right? And you were just talking about, you know, everybody saying everyone from the South is illegitimate, you know, dehumanizing. So how do you draw the line between not accepting the decisions that were made, but accepting the people that made the decisions and not canceling them as people? Craig, you had to deal with that with your father. You want to talk about that a little?
Oh, and before we move in to the next question, I want to thank you for sharing your story, and I'm sorry about your loss.
You know, George, one of the things that your question reminds me of, and Will and I were classmates together in the university during this time that we're talking about, 69, 70, tremendous amount of demonstration across all of our campuses across the United States. And here I am, Robert S. McNamara's son, Craig McNamara, protesting, and I don't ever remember anybody canceling me. Mm-hmm. So what does that say? I think that says, what does that say about society today? It says that we have a long way to go back to our historical roots, to find integrity, to find honesty, to allow people to have a voice, to speak with coherence, to speak the truth and allow that to happen. I'm not really answering your question,
well,
but it did harken back to my own experience as a 19-year-old.
Yeah. Now, that's, I felt there had to be something there because I just think people made all kinds of contributions to society, and they do one thing that nobody likes, and what they do is not nice, generally. Sometimes it's just ideological, and then it's really unfortunate because we have all these different cultures in the world. All those cultures are thousands of years old, mostly, being passed on. You can't just say, to me, the image is like a coral reef. You see a coral reef, and you come and see it and you say, well, it's beautiful except for this part over here. I don't like the way it formed over here. Let's just smash the whole coral reef and start over again. You know, it doesn't work like that. Coral reefs don't work like that. Human cultures don't work like that. This doesn't, never made another culture better by doing it. So we have to figure out some other way of dealing with it. So, another question. Anybody, there's time for one or two more questions?
Fred came over to me earlier because I think he recognized that I was probably from the generation that was most affected by the war, which was true. And the reason I came, I'm a longtime member of Commonwealth Club and I come to a lot of events. But when I saw this item on the calendar, I was amazed at the level of anger, even frankly hatred that I still carried against his father because of what he put me through in 1967 and 68 with the draft. And anybody who was a young male at that point knows the effect that had on them. And part of me just wanted to come and make sure he was really sorry. I hate to say that, but it's true.
Thank you.
But
thank you.
Well, thank you. But the odd thing is that I was so blinded by that I overlooked the fact that I have four children who were born in Vietnam, three of whom are the children of American GIs. They're adult children. I now have grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And it just occurred to me, if it wasn't for your father, I wouldn't have my wonderful, blessed family. Like they're put everywhere, I guess. And part of that is, and it's very real, because we live in the Bay Area where the cultures of Southeast Asia probably certainly wouldn't be as evident here and as prominent here and as rich here if it were not for the war, because all of the refugees would not have come here.
You have every right to be angry.
I think that response is just great because, you know, no matter how bad something is, we can make it better. All we have to do is make decisions that move it in that direction. If you think about World War II, the last super destructive war. And if you were in Berlin in 1944 as everything was coming to an end, You probably never would have imagined that 15 years later, the city would have been rebuilt and people would be living their lives again with their families and stuff like that. That's what people want. So, you know, if as long as our societies let us rebuild and look to the future, then whatever mistakes are made by leaders or whatever trying to accomplish something that may be a good idea, maybe just because they like to create chaos, you don't really know. But, you know, I know your father wasn't in that situation. He was a corporate leader before he went into government. He was a builder. So that wasn't his motivation. We have politicians that seem all they want to do is create chaos. And that's much harder to deal with because you can't reason with, you know, to them to a position of thinking differently about it. But that's all it takes is for everybody to get together and rebuild again and to stop whatever happened. And that has been done many, many times in history, just as often as the destruction. So I think people have to take some comfort and optimism from that. Who would like to ask the last question? Anybody else have a question? Okay, great.
On that note, let me thank the Commonwealth Club for all that you do for all of us for so many years. Thank you. And Kwemai, thank you for bringing us all together here today. What a remarkable opportunity to hear you at your first reading of your poems in English. So beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Greg, for being you my family now, okay?
Yes. Yep.
My family now. And I may just knock at your door because I love your farm. This book is so amazing. If you haven't read it, I encourage you to do because there are copies over there. And thank you to Barbara and of Green Apples Books for having copies of my novels, The Mount Singh and Dust Child, as well as The Color of Peace there. George, the philosopher, the author of so many books as well, get his books as well and read him because he's so amazing. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club, to the staff members who have been so helpful. And my friend, Mingha, can you stand up? Can you believe this young woman is a stand-up comedian? And she's writing her memoir, an IT guru as well. She's writing her memoir. So one day I want to see her on this stage talking Good. About her novel, her memoir. Thank you, Isabel, for hosting me at your house, cooking for me, driving me, and Viet for also, taking care of us. Want to thank so many people, each of you, for being here with us today. Your presence means the world to me, and I mean, it's an honor to have you witness this really historical conversation between Greg and I. And I can't say enough good things about this man. He's a kind person.
Thank you.
He's a kind person. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
What an extraordinary event. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 124th year of enlightened discussion. Thanks a lot for coming. We hope to see you again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.